So, welcome everyone to Inside the Cylinder, episode 115. And I am David Fernandez, writer over at Detroit Bad Boys. I will actually be writing some stuff here soon as we approach the off season and draft time and Pistons reviews. As always, I'm joined by fellow writer over at Detroit Bad Boys, Matt Way. What's up, Matt?
Hey, David. Recording this the night of the beginning of the play-in tournament. The Pacers are currently stomping all over the Charlotte Hornets, so I'm hoping that we're going to get a better game in the other Eastern game. But you know, it's just good to have playoff-ish basketball here after what we've watched all year.
And I am assuming, like, for records and whatnot, they can't be counting play-in as, like, the playoffs, right? You know, when you talk about, like, that Spurs record and, you know, the Red Wings had a similar record, right? Like, it seems like people not necessarily are confused at all when they discuss that, but you're hearing – I've heard some things where it's like they made the playoffs when they made the play-in, but I don't think you make the playoffs until you actually make the playoffs.
I think you're right. I'm pretty sure they do not count statistics in these games. Except, I guess they'll probably keep them in their own little category now.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to be too much associated with the play-in record games, but yeah, honestly, watching like the tip of that game for the Hornets and the Pacers, I was having like severe flashbacks, like almost PTSD to Pistons 2019. Eking into the playoffs just to get stomped that next round. So I'm glad that Detroit is firmly not playing in that game right now.
Yeah, I agree. It's fun from the outside. I feel like it's even worse, like, as a fan, to have, like, it all come down to one game and then just get crushed in the next round. I don't know. I don't know that I want the Pistons to be there next year. I hope they're not in it one way or another.
Yeah, well, we will see. But we do want to sort of put a postmortem on this season for this episode. And I'm sure most of you now have come to the, or you have seen that the Pistons had finished out the season 20-52. They somehow secured the second worst record in the league when, you know, I had written a few articles this year in my Commander of the Tank series, where I really thought that would be impossible for them to, I guess you could say, hop the Minnesota Timberwolves, but thanks to the Timberwolves looking like a competent basketball team over the past couple of weeks, Detroit was able to secure that second worst spot. And in doing so, and I had mentioned this on a couple previous podcasts, they now have an 80% odds of landing a top five pick. Or maybe it's 79.1, but I'm going to round up for that one. And one thing that I should note is that the Pistons have never moved up in the draft lottery. I think this would be the year to do it if you're going to move up from 2-1. But there's a lot of players to be excited about in this year's lottery, especially in the top five. Matt, any thoughts on, you know, I guess just the end of this season before we kind of get into a little bit of like a draft preview or pick 'em, if you will?
Yeah. You know, it was a successful season in some ways, in a lot of ways, I think. I think going into the season, we all expected the Pistons to end with this sort of record, 20-ish wins, maybe a few more. But, you know, more than that, the development of the younger players was just really fun to watch. The culture that Dwayne Casey and Troy Weaver are building was fun to watch build and grow. And, you know, it kind of ends with Dwayne Casey's one-year extension, which I think was, you know, just a nice gesture towards him. It doesn't mean he's going to be here for the long haul, you know, in 5 years or whatever, when they're hopefully contending. But, you know, he did such a good job this year, and his staff did in developing guys. And in, I think, just bringing them along in the right way, regardless of the pressure on them to, from the outside, to maybe play these guys, just throw them in the fire. I think that they did a good job in their development this year. And I think that that 1 year extension was very appropriate for Dwayne Casey.
Yeah. And we really did see solid performances out of all of these young players that we've talked about all season, you know, Sadiq Bey and Isaiah Stewart kind of being some of the more consistent guys. Frank Jackson really came on there sort of like the last couple months or last, yeah, couple months of the season. And Josh Jackson had some really nice performances, even though he hadn't played so well towards the end of the season. Tyler Cook looks like an NBA player. Saben Lee looks like an NBA player. So from like a developmental standpoint, it's definitely one of the more impressive seasons. And honestly, it's going to be just, or not necessarily you're guaranteed that by any means, but this was the year where these guys were going to play. Yeah, they might not have all gotten the minutes that you expected right off the bat, but come the end of this season, especially as we were, you know, hitting this sort of final stretch of the season, that's when we got what everyone was asking for all year, just letting the young kids run. And a lot of the guys have played really well. And I know you had mentioned it on a few times, Sekou Doumbouya being one of those guys as well, that we can be excited about next season going into it.
Yeah, it was fun to watch for a couple weeks. It was also clear that if we would have had to put up with 72 games of that, it would have been really, really long, a really, really long season, because it got pretty ugly. And I don't think it's in anyone's best interest to bottom out for the entire year the way they did in the last couple weeks. So of course, it was on purpose, certainly, to some degree. But I don't know about you, David, but I couldn't handle the full year of that.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that we're going to get into some draft conversation here real quick, but I'm really hoping that we don't have to do that. Now, obviously, Jeremy Grant is going to be in the lineup at the start of next season, so it's not going to be as bad as we had seen in quite a few games towards the end of this season. But at the same time, I had thought about that just kind of watching this team, thinking, I don't know how Sixers fans did that. Yeah, I really don't understand how they sort of went through that for as long as they did, year in, year out. Now, they're the number one seed in the Eastern Conference, so you can have arguments whether or not it all worked. But just in general, from like a basketball fan perspective, it would have been hard for me to keep the TV on if I'm knowing that that's for sure going to be like the strategy year in, year out, because it's not going to be the strategy for this team. Even if they are bad next year, it's not going to be strictly on purpose from the jump, you know. So that's kind of what I had been thinking sort of watching these last couple weeks of games.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it really all started to go down, not just when they were resting Jeremy Grant and Mason Plumlee and Corey Joseph, but once Frank Jackson kind of went down with his ankle injury and was, you know, he didn't play the last week, it got like extra ugly because the spacing was so bad. And that's certainly not going to be the case between Grant and hopefully Frank Jackson, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And you know, they have the room. I'm guessing they're going to have the room to add a couple guys, maybe bring in a couple better shooters this summer. So I don't expect it to be that ugly. And frankly, I think they have every ability to contend for at least a play-in spot next year, especially if they hit on the draft pick.
I agree. So let's get into this draft pick situation. I had mentioned that the Pistons now have locked up 80% odds for a top five pick. So we're only going to be talking about the top five here right now. And I was wondering, Matt, what's your top five right now? Like, in which order? And I'm assuming both you and I, if we get the number one pick, if Detroit gets the number one pick, we're slamming that Cade Cunningham button. I know I am, but I don't know. I assume that you are as well.
Oh, yeah. That's about as easy as it gets. Unless you're like offering me Luka Doncic, like I'm taking Cade Cunningham if I get the number one pick.
Okay, so we're in agreement there. So I want you to tell me, who would you be picking at number two?
Number two, I'm going to go Evan Mobley. The talent, I'm drafting for, given the Pistons situation, best player available. And I'm definitely emphasizing potential. Mobley is, I think he would be a number one pick in a lot of years. He is as fluid a defender at his height that I can ever remember seeing in college. I mean, that part of it, like, truly is Anthony Davis-esque in what he did at Kentucky. He's not Anthony Davis, like, not even close as a prospect, because the offense isn't at that level. But, you know, the offensive potential is there. He's going to be a good offensive player no matter what, and he has the potential to just be a devastating defender, I think. So he's an easy number two for me.
Okay. I'm a little more torn on this, honestly, but I think after thinking about it, especially I kind of tried to put some of the draft stuff in the rearview mirror and just letting this season finish out. I'm going to go in agreement with you on Mobley for everything that you just said. I think that the offense is going to come around. There's nothing there that I've seen out of the tape that I've watched in some of the games that I was able to watch, you know, in the tournament from him, that makes me think that there's any serious red flags on the offensive end of the floor. Obviously, as soon as he is able to put on weight and sort of build his actual NBA frame, that'll even start to progress even quicker. But for now, I agree with you. It's not that he's going to be Joel Embiid on the defensive end of the floor, like, for sure, but it says something when you're able to have that stabilizing of a presence on the defensive end of the floor. Like, that is a dominant defensive team, and one that is formidable, and it is all sort of based around how good of a defensive player that Joel Embiid is. So if you can sort of lock up one of those guys for your future and just build around that, that's going to be a very steadying presence for this young Pistons team as they sort of progress and hopefully get better throughout these upcoming years. So we're in agreement there.
Yeah, I think that's all fair.
All right. Who's your third?
So my third, this is easy-ish. Not as easy as the Mobley or the Cade picks to me, but I'm going Jalen Green 3. He has, I think, the potential to be and a good chance, really, to be the best scorer in this draft. He's somebody that could just really change the way the Pistons are able to play the game offensively in a way, in a similar sense that Cade is able to do that. You know, Jalen Green's not the passer Cade is. He's going to do it in different ways, but I think that Jalen Green has the potential to be such a good high volume scorer. His athleticism is just through the roof, and he's definitely going to be my number three at this point. I think he's got the third highest potential in this draft for sure.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. So I'm hoping that 4 and 5, we might be different. We might split there, but Jalen Green to me, it's a situation for me, honestly, where if the Detroit, and I know it's going to depend on how, like, the draft actually shakes out, but I feel like this is how a lot of NBA's teams' boards are looking like, for at least for picks 1 and 2. So for me, it's a situation where if the Pistons fall to 3, I'm A, not going to be terribly, like, mortified. It's not going to be one of those situations where you're just like, it's not a two-player draft, right? It's not a situation where you're like, oh my God, we're definitely missing out on the guy, and now we're going to get left with the scraps of the lottery. It's not one of those situations for me at all. So, I mean, I'll be on eggshells, essentially, on draft day if they are at 3 and Jalen Green is available. You know, I would be very, very hopeful that they would select him for everything that you just said. Honestly, I think he's going to be walking into the league. I think he's going to be, you know, kind of like in a production standpoint, in like that sort of Anthony Edwards, like, automatic 18, 19 points per game as soon as he touches an NBA floor. He just seems to have it on all three levels. As you mentioned it, he's a freak athlete. I'm not too concerned on the defensive end of the floor just because of his athleticism. I think he's going to be putting on the NBA weight throughout his career. So for me, very, very easy to go with Jalen Green there. And like I said, even if they fell and they ended up selecting him, I would not be an unhappy camper going into next season.
Okay. So you, how about you go with your fourth pick?
I'm going Jonathan Kuminga. I know he's very young. I know that he is not as polished as who a lot of people think might be going fifth, but I don't want to ruin it just yet. He's 6'6", 210 pounds. He looks like he already has an NBA frame. I know he, just kind of from watching some of those Ignite games, I was able to see him pop off in a couple of those games, and it looks like he's just going to figure it all out. And he's just I think he's going to be a problem on defense, and I think he's really going to figure it out on the offensive side of the floor. So this would also be one of those picks for me if they fell to four. Yeah, I'm not as stoked, but at the same time, I think that he's going to grow into a real difference maker in the NBA. So for me, I'm going Kuminga for sure.
So this one's kind of more to be determined for me. But right now, I'm going to agree with you. So we're going to agree one through four. And I'm guessing we're going to agree at five because, and you know, I agree with everything you said. I think he has the potential to be a primary creator. He's really quite a good passer. He definitely showed the ability to create for himself and others with the Ignite. He's definitely a lot more raw than the top three. There's no doubt about that. He's rawer than the other guard that's mentioned in the top three, four, five. But I guess where I'm coming from is if you, there's another guy you could pick here that would, I think, have the team in this like play-in territory next year, who doesn't have the sort of upside that Kuminga has. I think it's going to take longer for Kuminga to put it together. But what that would also do, if I don't get one of the top three, it would frankly improve your lottery odds next offseason, and you get another shot at a potential top three, top five pick. I think you're going to have a better shot with Kuminga. And frankly, I think he has, after Cunningham, Mobley, and Green, I think he's got the fourth highest potential in this draft.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So we are on the same page here, unless you have a surprise for me coming up. But for my fifth pick, and the guy that I would honestly be the least excited for, obviously, because we're talking about this from, you know, who I would want one, two, three, and four. So with fifth, it's going to be Jalen Suggs. Yeah, I think with him, when we had on Adam Spinella, he really did sell me on him, you know, just as sort of having a winning DNA. He's got pretty good size. Like, he's 6'4", so the Pistons would have a backcourt with, you know, with Suggs 6'4", and with Killian coming in at 6'5". He doesn't have like this crazy wingspan, but he's just got a good feel for the game. I know the shot is a little bit concerning, but it doesn't look concerning to me when I watch it on film. He's a good decision maker with the ball. I think he's pretty good in the pick and roll, honestly. He seems pretty unselfish in what I've been able to watch out of that Gonzaga team. So, and he seems like a very competent defender. So I think he's a very, very good prospect. I think, honestly, last year he might have been a top three pick had he gone, if he was available for the draft last year. But for me, I know he's a little bit on the streakier side when it comes to shooting, but I don't know. I think that he's going to be a fine, fine NBA player. I just don't know if he has like this sort of just insane upside that we're seeing from these top four guys. And with Kuminga, it might be a little bit more of a risk because he is a lot younger. But with just from the upside perspective, he'd be the guy that I'd be least excited for. But at the end of the day, I still wouldn't be mad at that pick. I think that he'd be the no-brainer fifth overall pick if that's where Detroit does end up falling.
Yeah, I think that Suggs might be the safest pick in the top five outside of Cade. He's definitely NBA ready to me. He's a super smart player. I think he's going to be a great defensive player. I remember hearing like a Drew Holiday comparison, which I think is maybe a decent comparison. Maybe like a Deron Williams, like in his prime, that type of really good point guard guy who can play kind of both guard positions. I'm not seeing the upside to get into number to get him ahead of especially Green, but even Kuminga. I explained my other kind of reasons for that. I might have Suggs over Kuminga by the end when I do a little more looking at their film. But for me, I just think that Suggs is head and shoulders above anyone else that comes on the board. And I would be happy with him, you know, if Detroit really likes him and they took him three, like I'm not going to jump up and down. I would prefer Jalen Green. But
would you be very upset? Let's say they fall to three and they pick Suggs instead of Green. Cause I would be,
I would be disappointed. I don't think I'd be upset. I would wait to see, you know, what happened, especially after this past off season when I didn't seem to really understand what they were doing and it's worked out well. I think Troy Weaver's, earned some, he's earned the benefit of the doubt. Especially with his eye for the draft. So I'm curious what they're going to do. I would love to see their big board right now. You know, and Jalen Suggs is certainly a good culture guy. So that could play a factor, but if it's me, this is really the draft to go upside. And I think he has the least upside of the consensus top five.
I would completely agree with that. Honestly, I could find myself in a few weeks just getting a little too deep down Jalen Green highlights and then, you know, wanting him too over Mobley. So I'm very, very high about him. And I said it already, but if they wound up with him, I would 100% be extremely excited and maybe in line to purchase one of his jerseys once they release those. But if Cade Cunningham gets selected, I'm buying it the first day it comes out. That is, you're going to hear it here first. So yeah, I know this was just a little quick hitter on the draft. We'll take a deeper dive again down the road here as we approach the draft lottery and the draft. But I wanted to move over to probably like the biggest news in Pistons land from this past week. And that is Ben Wallace being elected into the Basketball Hall of Fame. So round of applause for Ben Wallace. I think it was something that I've been waiting for a while now, or not waiting for a while now, but someone that I had expected and, you know, was kind of looking forward to this day. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on Ben Wallace getting into the Hall of Fame? I don't know if he was eligible in years prior. I think he was. So that's why I'm saying finally, but I'd have to double check on that.
Yeah, he's been eligible for a while.
Okay, that's what I thought.
I figured it would take some time just because he was who he was. You know, he wasn't an offensive player, but he was just an incredible defensive player. Anyone who watched the Pistons during that time knows that he, you know, it said a lot about that team, those teams that they didn't really have a superstar. To me, Ben Wallace was the superstar, you know, four-time defensive player of the year. He probably could have gotten another one. He was, you know, before you see a lot of guys really kind of coming out of nowhere and with great timing and help defense these days, like that wasn't really the case in 04. You know, everybody kind of remembers Tayshaun's chase down block, but the guy who would just do that routinely, just kind of come out of nowhere and with perfect timing was Ben Wallace. I think he was a generational, transformational defender, and I'm super happy for him.
Yeah, 100% agreed. He made the All-NBA team five times. He was four-time All-Star, six times All-Defense, two-time rebounding leader, one-time block leader, and he was the linchpin of that Pistons team that, you know, made it to the Eastern Conference Finals a bunch of times in a row, made it to, you know, obviously won the championship. So for me, you know, and especially just sort of knowing the presence, and I think it's might get lost on people just kind of looking at numbers nowadays, is like he meant so much, not just to like the city and like the team, but just like setting the standard for Pistons basketball of that generation. for a really, really good Pistons team. So for me, it was something where I had been waiting for. I knew that it was going, I was hoping it was going to come. I've gotten in arguments with people on Twitter whether or not he was going to be a Hall of Famer. But you're the four-time best defensive player of, you know, best defensive player in the league. You mentioned that there was one year where Ron Artest got it, and I might have been just a young fan and had thought that that should have been Ben Wallace's again. But, you know, I just think that there's some hate going on out there right now. I don't necessarily understand it, just kind of given what he was able to do, both from like the accolade standpoint and then also like the team that he sort of formed, like that identity was like based around Ben Wallace, and that was such a good Pistons team and a champion Pistons team.
Yeah, he really was like a he was almost like an icon in the city, you know, for like a 4 or 5 year stretch. You know, you walked around at Halloween and like everyone was Ben Wallace. Like 50% of everyone in the state of Michigan was Ben Wallace for Halloween.
There were so many froze in the palace. Like people,
oh my gosh,
froze.
It he was
a pro, man, no fly zone.
He was as well liked a Detroit athlete as you'll ever probably find. You know, he was like Steve Yzerman, you know, for basketball fans. Over, you know, it wasn't a long stretch, but it was just an incredible period for the Pistons, and Ben Wallace was, to me, easily the biggest reason for that. I really, really believe, you know, Chauncey was great, and I think Chauncey gets underrated in everything too, and I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. But Ben was just head and shoulders the most valuable member of those Pistons teams, and you saw a real drop off when he went to Chicago.
Yeah, and for him too. You know, I think that he had spoken about that before, saying it probably they paid him, you know, so I understand it from like a personal decision, and don't blame him at all for that. But, you know, I think he had mentioned something along the lines of sort of losing a little bit of the fervor for the game once he did leave Detroit. I did want to mention, so I was listening to, and this was because I wanted to hear their takes on the Ben Wallace selection. So I don't listen to all the Bill Simmons podcasts, but I did listen to him and Russillo this past week. And they were having this, like, get off my lawn conversation about, like, they're letting everyone in the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame's like meant to be like the Hall of Fame, and they shouldn't let that many people in. And Russillo went down this like tangent about Ben Wallace, saying, talking about his offensive game and that he's never averaged double digits, and that one of his buddies said that he was like one of the best defensive players and that he should have gotten in. And Russillo was saying, well, you have to play two sides of the ball. In the NBA, it's not like an NFL thing where if you're on defense, you're strictly on defense. So he just went on this long tangent, you know, blasting Ben Wallace's selection into the Hall of Fame. And he wasn't blasting him as like a player specifically, just his selection. But I had some issues with that, just because there's a couple things that came to mind for me. We already talked about one of it, that he was the linchpin. He was the, you know, just like the base for that Pistons team, which I think is really, really important to note. But at the same time, this was a different league back then. This was a team that held teams to under 70 points for, I don't remember what the record was, but it was like 8 straight games or something like that. It was pretty ridiculous. I don't know if you do know that record, Matt.
I do not.
It was a lot of games. It was a different era of basketball. It was an era of basketball where teams weren't high flying. They weren't scoring a ton of points. You would regularly see like a 76-70 playoff game. So the fact that he was so hyper-focused on the defensive end of the floor when defense really did sort of win championships for the most part, I think that is something that is just kind of like flippantly overlooked. That, yeah, he wasn't a great offensive player. He didn't have a jump shot. He didn't have many post moves. But he was so, so dominant. Nobody wanted to play against the Pistons. Nobody wanted to go into the paint against Ben Wallace. And just the fact that you can kind of just overlook that and overlook the era that their greatness was in just seems very, convenient to just kind of just gloss over that. So I wanted to bring that up just because my whole time I was listening to that, I was just thinking, it's like, do you remember what the games were like back then? It's like, and they also had competent guys on the floor with them. So it wasn't like they needed him to be an offensive player and that he was just throwing up a shit ton of bricks. It was something where it's like, no, he knows his role. He's going to play his role really well to the tune of winning Defensive Player of the Year 4 times. I don't know how you don't reward that accolade alone with getting into the Hall of Fame. And when Rudy Gobert might get there at some day, then he deserves it too. Sorry, that's my rant.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, it ignores all the players who are in the Hall of Fame or will get in the Hall of Fame who were great offensive players and didn't really play defense. You know, it's not even backwards. It's just a wrong way of how people think about basketball, where points are the only thing that matters. And, you know, Ben Wallace might be the least skilled offensive player in the Hall of Fame, but I'm going to venture to guess that he's not actually like the least valuable or the most negative offensive player in the Hall of Fame, because he was an incredible offensive rebounder. He knew his role. Like he finished, or, you know, he got a lot of points just on putbacks. And, you know, that Pistons team often struggled to make shots, and Ben extended possessions a lot of times through his rebounding. And he was actually a pretty good passer too, which gets overlooked, I think, with Ben. And, you know, there's guy, you know, everybody probably has scored more points than him in their career, or at least like on a per game average. But Ben also did a lot of things on the offensive end. He was a great screener as well that have real value. And I don't even know that he was like this massive negative that everyone just perceives him to be offensively, but that's just kind of the way that the more casual fan, I think, just analyzes basketball.
That's a good way of putting it. You know, that he was impactful on the offensive end of the floor, you know, getting those offensive rebounds, kicking it back out, restarting possessions, giving Chauncey another look, giving Rip another look, all valuable. And it came in clutch time and time again for that team. Also, looking back on that finals against the Lakers, not that this is really matters or would be in his resume at all, my man was hitting solid 14 foot jumpers on the baseline in that finals. He was stroking. So when it mattered most, my guy was putting up some buckets. I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking back about that team, thinking back about that finals when they absolutely dismantled the Lakers. I don't want to hear anything about Karl Malone being healthy, because Karl Malone doesn't erase 18 point deficits. So that argument is just one of the ones that I just feel like people are going galaxy brain when they want to bring that up. But yeah, I just wanted to bring that up about Ben Wallace and his rightful spot in the Hall of Fame. So I know it wasn't necessarily like the longest trajectory of dominance, but during it was just absolute dominance. It was like something that you haven't really seen before from an undrafted player, from a player at his size playing at that position in a league where centers were very traditional in their size, and his ability to sort of bang with those bodies. He was strong as an ox, stronger than a lot of the centers he went up against. Everyone remembers the block against Shaq that sent him flying to the floor. I don't know. I just don't think how you can just sort of selectively just decide to, I guess, just view it through that vacuum of it being short, or just you view it through the vacuum of him not being a great offensive player, compared to some of the other like high profile scorers that have obviously made the Hall of Fame. So I just wanted to make sure I put that on the record.
Yeah. And, you know, there is an argument to be made. It's not that Ben Wallace's offense was bad because he didn't score points. Like the argument is what you kind of just said, is that his peak just wasn't very long. And if that was the reason that that he stayed out of the Hall of Fame, like that's at least a rational argument. The rest of it, like the stuff that actually gets brought up, you know, and kind of on the flip side, like that Lakers series, you know, everyone acts like he just dominated Shaq, which Shaq put up like crazy numbers in that series. He was more efficient than like he ever was in the regular season on high usage. He did slow him down for three games, but two of the games Shaq just went crazy. I think games one and maybe three, or games one and four, games one and three. So those arguments are all kind of silly, I think. But the bottom line is you can't keep a four-time defensive player of the year out of the Hall of Fame when that's only been done one other time.
Yeah, I think that would honestly just set a bad precedent for that award almost, right? Like it's something where it's just like a footnote of someone's career where it should be a little bit more highly celebrated. But the guys that win that title are, you know, they hang their hat on that end of the floor. Draymond Green, Rudy Gobert, you know, it's something that they really care about. And I think it's important that you do have guys in this league, you know, in this generation, obviously it was in previous generations and in future generations, to really give a shit about that end of the floor and to, you know, covet that type of award. So, so I understand what you're saying there, Matt, for sure. And about that finals, honestly, I had rewatched it during early quarantine. And part of me while watching it was thinking, they should have been throwing this ball down to Shaq every single possession. There was just times where he would just disappear for some reason for 5 minutes at a stretch. And it's like, this would be a completely different game if you could have kept it close in the first half. And it was really strange. I don't blame him for leaving after that, honestly, because that was insane to me to see how little they went to Shaq and how he was actually very, very dominant in that series. He was the only one that was playing well for the Lakers in that series.
Yeah, he really was. Rick Fox was probably their second best player for much of that series because Kobe just shot so poorly. I like you, watched the series back early in quarantine. Actually, I wrote about it a little bit for Hoops Habit. And it's, you know, it's funny in the entire context of this to talk about that. Like, if you go and watch that game closely, you'll see just Detroit run like very simple actions, like just switching the corners. They did like a bunch of times because the Lakers like couldn't stop it. And that's like, the game wasn't sophisticated back then, but people still had trouble stopping those basic actions. But against Ben Wallace, like you had to run sophisticated stuff. And even then, he was so smart, his timing was so good that it just didn't matter because he just erased whatever you tried to do. It was such a fun era to watch.
It was, and that was definitely a highlight of early quarantine for me. There weren't many going on back then, but being able to rewatch those games, I was very excited when ESPN decided to air those. And yeah, if you get the chance, you haven't watched those games, you're a younger fan, maybe listening to this, it's not going to be the scoring that you're used to, but it was still very exciting basketball, and it was just an absolutely dominant performance by the Pistons. Now, speaking of a less dominant Pistons team, this one, the one that we've been talking about all year, I did just want to quickly talk about this. We'll probably get a little bit more into like a deeper dive Pistons free agency episode in the future, but Pistons free agents. So I want to know, you know, your thoughts on who comes back, who leaves. So I'm going to go over, I guess we'll do it one by one. Matt, Hamidou Diallo, is he coming back?
I think so. I think Troy Weaver traded him with the intention of re-signing him. He's a restricted free agent, so they'll be able to match any sort of offer. He had an up and down year in Detroit, but the highs were so high. He had a really good game, either the last game or the second to last game of the year, where he can be a very valuable player to this rebuild. He fits what they want to do. He's a long, athletic guy who can just do a number of different things. The shooting we saw glimpses of this year, and I'm sure they're going to continue to work on that. But if he becomes a competent shooter, like not even a good shooter, if he's a competent shooter, he could be a solid starter or just a really big piece coming off the bench in the future.
Yeah, I agree. And I think some of the highs that we saw from him this year, even like the short time he was with Detroit, were higher than any of the highs that we had seen from him previously, you know, with his time with the Oklahoma City Thunder. So I think he definitely showed enough and is someone that has like the right attitude too. He doesn't seem to be a guy that really cares whether or not he's in the starting lineup or coming off the bench. He's saw a variety of that while he was with Detroit so far this year. And I think the shot will hopefully, you know, begin to start to progress even more, but we did see glimpses of it. We saw a 35-point outing, like you mentioned, from him. So I think he definitely showed enough to warrant coming back to this team. So let's move forward to Frank Jackson. We're not necessarily sure if he's a restricted free agent or a free agent. So just want to get that out there. Matt, do you have anything on that? I know that you had talked to James Edwards about it a little bit, but something with the two-way thing.
Yeah, so he's listed everywhere as like unrestricted. James in his column this morning, and he kind of talks about this this kind of exercise. He lists Frank as a restricted free agent. The James screenshotted the NBA, I guess, definition of restricted or how they determine that, and it matches up with Larry Kuhn's FAQ, which says that two-way guys are restricted free agents after like 15 games of service or something like that. So regardless, I think you got to bring Frank Jackson back. He's, I think, only 22. He's, you know, he matches the timeline. He brings much needed shooting, and he showed he can even do a little more than that. He works real hard defensively. And I think you can get him for relatively cheap, even though he was so good late in the year. So I think you have to, you don't have to, but I think you definitely want to bring Frank Jackson back.
And I think they're going to. I think there's a reason why they showcased him as much as they did this year. They really wanted to see what he was as a player. And it wasn't the longest stretch of him playing really well because he didn't look too hot when he started out the season. But what we did see from him, he punches in bunches, man. I mean, he's someone that can get really, really hot and really turn around a game for your team. He, as you mentioned, he fits the timeline. He'd probably be the best shooter, at least if he could keep up what he was doing towards like that, you know, the beginning of the last third of the season up next season. Probably the best shooter on the team. So, and with the team as spatially challenged as Detroit is, I think that he's definitely a guy that will be coming back to Detroit. And I hope that they do, especially as you mentioned, with the timeline, the contract that they hopefully would be able to get him at, should all bode well for this team moving forward, whether or not he's on like the team 4 years from now, or if he's just on the team for the next year or two. So I'm all about bringing Frank Jackson back. I think he definitely, for me, it's like, did you show me enough, right? Like the next guy we're going to talk about is Dennis Smith Jr. And I'm going to say that he's definitely not coming back. And I don't think it has anything to do with the knee. I think it really has more to do with how well did you play while you were in Detroit. And I just don't think I saw enough out of him consistently to say you're a guy that's going to be coming back on a team that it has at least a couple of options at point guard right now that they trust in Saben Lee. Trust is might be a little overstated, but Saben Lee and Killian Hayes. So for me, I think Dennis Smith Jr. Will probably be latching on to another NBA team at the minimum next year.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that third spot's going to go to, you know, a combo guard that Dwayne Casey's familiar with, or at least is comfortable with. You know, whether they bring Corey Joseph back, he's got a non-guaranteed contract for next year. You know, obviously early in the year, you had DeLon Wright. Like, I just see them having an option like that to help Killian, help Saban, and just make probably the coaching staff a little more comfortable as well.
For sure. So the guy that I kind of struggled with the most here is Wayne Ellington. Now, I don't think that he's going to be back next year. And I know this is a team that needs shooting. I don't know if he wants to come back. I don't know. He played really well throughout this season, at least to start out this season. He was absolutely on fire. He was like leading the league in 3-point shooting. So I don't think it's going to be a situation where he's going to be out of the league next year by any means. But for me, I don't know. I know Troy Weaver had mentioned that they're going to be bringing veterans onto this team in their free agency moves. I guess, differentiated from the guys that they plan on bringing back who might be a little bit younger. But I don't know if Wayne Ellington is going to be that guy. So I don't know if he is going to come back. But if I were to bet on it, I would say that he is not a Piston next year.
I agree. I think they'll probably want to go a little younger, even if they want a veteran in there and a shooter. Those are kind of a dime a dozen. Wayne was a super late signing. So maybe if they don't find anyone they like in free agency or in the draft, that they bring them in, they bring Wayne in at the end again. But I suspect they probably want to go a little younger. You know, maybe you bring in like a Ben McLemore or somebody like that who can potentially kind of grow with the team a little bit and develop some chemistry if he's a guy that you want to see more long-term with the team.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Rodney Magruder, I think this one's pretty easy. Wishing him the best in whatever it is that, you know, hopefully if he latches onto a team next year. I just don't really see it. He kind of was like the last piece of insurance that you could, I guess you could say, from like shooting guard. He played a little bit of point guard this year too. I really don't see him coming back just because those guys you can definitely find. And I think that they might be looking for people who they expect to play in that sort of veteran capacity next season alongside these young guys. And I think Magruder really more so got his chances and his opportunities due to injuries and guys being out this year. So it was really seemed like more of a situation where they were sort of forced to play him. Not that he played all that terribly, but I just don't see him, you know, as what you just said, Matt, maybe a guy that's a little bit younger of a veteran to join this team in maybe a similar role. But I don't see Rodney Magruder being that guy.
Yeah, I don't either. I think they signed or they traded for him, acquired him because of his contract. He's got a non-guaranteed deal next year. So I think the thought is you just cut him, give yourself a little more cap room and find a guy that you like a little better that's going to fit more long term.
Well, I don't think I have much more. Matt, do you?
I don't think so. I think that covers it. I'm sure we'll be back in the near future to talk about Pistons developments, but I think we're going to be a little more sporadic in the offseason. There's just not a whole lot to talk about right now.
Yeah, so we are going to be taking a little bit of a break here. Definitely we'll ramp up some coverage as we approach the draft lottery, maybe after that. Well, Matt and I will talk about it. We don't have like a set schedule right now, so we're going to be leaving you. I know maybe there's going to be some other Pistons pods out there for you, but for now, that is Inside the Cylinder. That's the 2021 postmortem ep. And we will be catching you all down the road. But for Matt, I am David. Catch us on Inside the Cylinder on Detroit Bad Boys, on the Detroit Bad Boys podcast stream, and on Twitter at Inside the CYLNDR. And we will catch you all later.